You are listening to the Tour des Flâneurs, the cycling podcast at the 2021 Tour de France, powered by Super Sapiens. Energy management for committed athletes and coaches. Stage 19. Today we're in Libourne.
Hello, my name is Richard Moore. I'm with the Marseille prosecutor, François Thomazeau.
New nickname.
New nickname.
Why not? Yeah.
And the Melbourne mullet, Mitch Docker.
Great to be here again in a beautiful location tonight.
Where are we? Where are we, François?
We're not far from Saint-Emilion. We're in a little village just outside of Saint-Emilion. And we're really in the middle of vines. I mean, you know, there are vineyards all over the place. And we're very, very near some of the most prestigious vintages in French wine and in world wine. I mean, you know, we went past coming here. Well, of course, Saint-Emilion, Pomerol. And, you know, we actually were hoping, you know, in the car to go past Petrus or Chateau Yquem, probably the most famous wines in the world, but we didn't. Well, I'll go back to Petrus tomorrow and we'll, you know, we have nothing else to do during the time trial.
We turned up and our hotelier, I think he was play acting a bit, but he was shocked when Mitch asked him if he had some local beer.
He wasn't impressed at all. And then I asked him, oh, well, no problem. Where's the closest brewery?
anyway, we are in wine country. Tomorrow is the wine trial, the penultimate stage of Tour de France, the time trial. I think the we're actually almost on the course here, pretty much.
Yeah.
So we'll maybe go out and recce that in the morning. It's a 30-kilometer time trial. Not a lot at stake in the time trial, it has to be said, in terms of the GC, but today was the penultimate chance for the sprinters, or so we thought. It didn't quite turn out like that. It was another really interesting and exciting stage, actually, one that you couldn't really take your eyes off on our long journey from a complicated day, wasn't it? We had quite a bit of distance to cover. There were a few mishaps along the way. It's kind of traditional, because one of the last times I was here and we did a similar journey from Pau up to Bordeaux, I realized halfway to Bordeaux that I'd left my very nice shoes back in Pau, and we made the rather eccentric decision to turn back for them.
Oh my gosh.
And missed the finish of the stage. Nothing like that happened today.
Well.
Anyway, two non-starters this morning as we set out on stage 19, 207 kilometers up to Libourne. Michael Woods, Israel Startup Nation, and Miguel Angel Lopez of Movistar, two, you know, highly fancied riders at the start of the tour Superman has not had a great time of it. Mike Woods has had his crashes, but he's been up the road as well. He's been challenging for the King of the Mountains jersey. Good friend of yours, Mitch. And we know, I mean, you've spoken to him a few times the last couple of days. He's been pretty much running on empty, hasn't he?
He has, yeah. And I think, look, there wasn't really much else to achieve. In saying that, of course, Woodsy is a team man. And as soon as Israel was chasing today,
he dodged a bullet, didn't he?
He did dodge a bullet.
Not starting today.
But I just know Woodsy, he would have loved to have been there doing it for the team. You know, that's the type of guy he is, to be able to give back. For everyone helping him, he's a guy who really gets off on that. So he would have hated leaving the tour, but like I said, there's probably not much more to gain. He was empty, he was injured, and he knows he's got a big goal just around the corner with the Olympic Games, and looks like that suits him down to the ground.
Well, as I say, we expect a sprint finish today, a chance today for Mark Cavendish to go for Eddie Merckx's, well, to go for the record that he holds along with Eddie Merckx at the moment of 34 stage wins, but a chance today for number 35. Eddie Merckx was there at the start, and there was a warm embrace between the two of them. Well, Merckx had clearly paid off a few of the teams to make it more difficult for Cavendish.
Well, actually not, because he said at the start, I mean, I was there, you know, I was interviewing Christian Prudhomme for a story I'm writing on Tour de France and wine, which might interest some of you guys. Well, we might come back to it tomorrow with little stuff from Luke Durbridge and other wine enthusiasts in the peloton. But and Merckx was on the podium at the village, and he said, and he was asked the question, you know, and he said, "Well, I really would like for
my goodness, we're joined by Eddie Merckx,
yeah. For Mark to win his 35th stage, so that we you know, don't talk about it again, you know. So he really wished for...
Well, thanks, Eddie, and welcome back, Francois.
So he was very, you know, yeah, he put it straight, like, you know, he wants the CAF to win the 35th stage. So, you know, no more, you know, no more about this record, you know.
So Cavendish doesn't want to talk about the record and neither does Merckx.
Yeah, well, that's it. Now, Merckx wants it, you know, finished. Once CAF is the only one, you know, record stage winner with 35 wins, nobody will say he's beaten Merckx.
Nobody will ever talk about it again.
Nobody will talk about Merckx again.
The record that dare not speak its name. It was the subject of our Kilometre Zero today. Lionel has made a great episode all about Mark Cavendish and the quest for the record, which rolls now onto Paris, where we fully expect a bunch sprint and another chance for him to try and claim the record outright. I mean, as I say, we were all expecting a bunch sprint, and you spoke at the start, Mitch, to Luka Mezgic of Team Bike Exchange. He's a fast sprinter in his own right, but he's been helping Michael Matthews in his quest to try and take the green jersey. And it was interesting hearing what he said at the start, particularly with the benefit of hindsight, knowing what happened in the stage. Let's hear from him now.
All right, Luka Mezgic, mate, you're looking bloody lean. Ridiculous. How are you?
Well, man, I've been on a regime. High altitude.
No. Well, you mean the last 2 days?
Yeah, last 3 weeks. No, I've been feeling good. I'm climbing good like last year. So I survived a little bit easier the whole 3 week tour. So I'm a bit fresher now in the last 2 days of potential sprint.
I saw how fresh you were, because the last couple of leadouts you've done for Michael in the intermediates were amazing, especially a couple of intermediates ago where Michael took it. You hit out early on the right. It was a really, really great move. So you've been reading the sprints well, but also feeling really well.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to compete myself and Michael against the whole Quickstep squad. You know, they have 4 guys in the last K, so I have to bring Michael there. Normally, Derps and Chris do their job around 5 to 3K to go. So in the very final, I'm alone there. And yeah, a lot of times I spend too much energy to do a proper lead out. But anyway, it's the most important is that Michael is fresh and on a good wheel before the sprint starts, and that's my job.
I think that's what we know too. Sometimes the lead out is actually placing him in a good position. It's not doing the 5 pedal strokes on the front, the glory job. Sometimes it's the dirty work. And like you said, with the team like Quickstep, they've got it drilled. You're going to have to do the dirty work. What's going to happen at the start? You guys going to help try and control things, shut it down so it's going to be a sprint, or are you just going to let the race roll on? Because potentially it's going to be a really hard race. Lots of teams still need to achieve something. Today's the last day, really.
That's a good point, good question actually. It can turn both ways, so it can be a bigger group, because also Cavendish can just lose today, you know. If he drops a chain, if he crashes in the end, if he's out of position, and maybe Michael take those necessary points, the green jersey can swap. And yeah, there's a risk also for Quickstep to take control of today's sprint. But I think their egos and their way of racing, you know, the Wolfpack, they will go all in, and they want to achieve also the breaking record for Kev.
Well, that was Luka Mezgic. She also spoke to Mads Pedersen, the former world champion Trek Segafredo rider this morning. And again, with hindsight, some of what he said is really, really interesting.
It's really interesting. You know, he wanted a hard start. He certainly got that. It looked like the break was going to go, but then when things kicked off, really again after that intermediate, he got his hard start he wished for, and the kilometres certainly ticked by. But especially the two guys he spoke about getting in the break jumped straight in there. You know, Jasper Stuyven and Edward Toones. I was going to say Dylan Toones. Edward Toones got in there, you know, just as he predicted. He wasn't hoping for that because he wanted to have a big sprint, but he predicted they'd go up the road.
Well, let's hear what Pedersen said this morning.
Mads, how are you, mate?
Ah, looking forward to Paris now, but another day to stay focused, and then we can take a chill from there.
You're looking forward to Paris already? Mate, this race feels like it's only just getting going.
Yeah, as Tomsey would say, the real Tour de France starts today.
But maybe you can have some fun today. Final sort of 2 more sprint days. How are you feeling? Are you going to have a go today? What's your feeling after the mountains?
Like, I feel quite okay. Like, I had some sickness and struggled a bit with it also during this week, but it's getting better. So I'm Yeah, my personal view is I'm really looking forward for sprint, but the team have another opinion, and maybe it's going to be a breakaway day also. It really also depends on what Quickstep they want to do. If they want to be sure with the green jersey, they let 10 or 12 guys go, and then Caffey is he's sure to have green in Paris. On the other hand, no one was beating him so far in the sprint, so it could also be they want to sprint, and to make it even more clear, he's in the green in Paris.
How are you feeling? Are you feeling like you want to have sort of a pretty easy day and have a real big sprint, or you want to try and have a fast, hard race? I can't imagine, but I'm just going to ask that question anyway.
Like, of course, it would mentally it would be nice with an easy day and then just full focus in the end, but I think it would be, on the other hand, to keep myself focused and so on, it would also be nice with a long and hard start to get also a few kilometers done. It's a long stage, and yeah, you also know it's pretty annoying to have a 210k stage in the end of a grand tour. So if it could keep going for a while, it would be nice, and then we can settle down and then hopefully sprint in the end.
So how are you guys going to beat Quickstep today? Just say it comes to the end, because they've got a really awesome train at the moment, and I'm sure you will agree they seem like they've got it dialed super fast. What's your tactic, do you reckon, to try and get around their train today?
Yeah, the problem is Jasper and Edward, they are trying to go on the break, and that's clearly my leader, guys. So I'm more, you know, free rolling today, and hopefully I'm getting a good wheel in the end. I don't think Quickstep would be the right wheel if I'm alone. I'm more for Alpecin to go in Philipsen's wheel, and then hopefully I can come from behind with a good speed.
So Mezgec there fully expected the egos of the Wolfpack to do all they could to ensure a bunch sprint today, but really they did absolutely nothing to
small point here, but if we stick to mathematics, we've had two Slovene wins in the mountains where the spoiler alert, we've had a Slovenian win today. We're probably going to have a Slovenian win tomorrow in the time trial. So if the trend continues, we could have a Slovenian winner on the Champs-Élysées, and could be Mezgec, you know, if things don't go well for Matthews, who knows?
Also be just, you know, one of those lead outs that just keep going and going and going, and you know, I could see him doing that.
Fanciful, but fun.
Another little tangent, but somebody in our Facebook chat group, the Cycling Podcast Facebook group, suggested today that the Slovenian story is very reminiscent of Ireland in the 80s with two absolute superstars. Back then it was Roach and Kelly, and then two very strong support riders. Back then, Martin Early and Paul Kimmage. Martin Early was a stage winner in the Tour de France as well. It's a great comparison. Slovenia's even smaller than Ireland, but there's a similar sort of thing happening, it seems. Anyway, break went up the road, early doors, Julian Bernard, your teammate Mitch Jonas Ruch, who would have a big impact on the stage actually, Simon Clark, Frank Bonnemore, constant attacker in this year's tour, and George Zimmerman, also a regular attacker of Intermarché. Matty Moric bridged across. So he was in that first breakaway. Then there were a couple of crashes in the bunch. Enric Mas, Guillaume Martin, also Mark Cavendish all fell off. And that caused a bit of chaos. While Movistar were still chasing to get back on, Alps and Fenix were riding quite hard at the front of the bunch. And they seemed to be the team taking the initiative to try and keep it together for a bunch sprint, not the Koenig Quickstep. And after the intermediate sprint, which was won by Michael Matthews, by Sonny Colbrelli, Matthews was edged out. A very strong group formed at the front and rode clear. Now, as one or two people said at the start, there are a lot of teams in this race still with nothing, and a lot of those teams are represented in this group. It had some very strong riders. Niels Pollitt was there already at stage winner. Mike Tournesen, Edward Toones, and Jasper Stuyven of Trek Segafredo. Davide Ballerini of the Koenig Quickstep. There was also quite a representation from Movistar. Three riders, Valverde, Garcia Cortina, and Arcas. But they dropped back a bit later on. Christophe Laporte was there, Sylvain Dillier, Michael Valgren, Greg Van Avermaet, Elie Gisbert, Casper Pedersen. I'll not go through all the names. Brent Van Moor, I've almost gone through all the names. But anyway, big group. And there were a few teams that missed out. And we saw Israel Startup Nation, Ineos Grenadiers, and rather bizarrely, considering Mohorich was up the road, Bahrain Victorious, chasing quite hard. And the gap was being held for quite some time until it opened up, and then there was no going back. It very quickly expanded to 10 minutes, and that was it. The stage was going to be decided by the riders up the road. The attack started quite early. Niels Pollitt was aggressive. Then Matti Moric went away with 26 kilometres to go. He's won a stage already, of course. He's clearly in great form in this tour. He won the stage. Mitch, watching it, you made the comment that the group behind looked like a horrible group to be in because there was no cohesion at all. There was no organisation. It was just guys jumping, taking turns at jumping to try and get across either on their own or in a small group.
Even before Moric left, that group looked horrible to be in because that is normally what would happen with 10K to go. But things are starting earlier and earlier now. We've seen with some other guys who are winning, they're going at 40, 50K to go. So the attacking today started, I think, at about 50 kilometres to go. And from there on in, it was just attack after attack after attack. And being in those groups, the worst thing is that you can be just sitting in a wheel and the guy in front of you just won't follow the wheel. And you're just sometimes just sitting in the bunch in the group is not sitting in the bunch. And sometimes better just to be off the front because you're closing gaps and missing jumps. And it's just such a hard situation to be in.
Well, Moric benefited from that because he rode away to the win and he celebrated the win. Remember, of course, two nights ago, last night's episode, we were talking about a police raid on the Bahrain Victorious Hotel a couple of nights ago in Pau, organised by the Marseille prosecutor, not Francois. He just happens to be from Marseille.
What do you know?
Yeah. Well, Moric seemed to be he was pretty angry about that. Yesterday, we heard him in last night's podcast, and he seemed to be fueled by that a little bit today. And then he, as he crossed the line, he gave this gesture of sort of hand across the lips, in a kind of don't speak. Be quiet sort of gesture, which he was asked about at the end. Well, we'll hear from him a bit later on that, because there were echoes of a gesture that Lance Armstrong made several years ago in a different context. And I'm pretty sure there wasn't a reference to that in Moritz's gesture, but it did rub a few people up the wrong way, that's for sure. Christophe Laporte was a very impressive second, held off Casper Pedersen. No change in the overall. Pog, Vingegaard, Carapaz, and they'll probably be in the same order tomorrow night after the time trial. Cavendish in the green jersey, 304 points to Matthews, 269. And that's pretty much the tale of the attack.
The Cycling Podcast at the 2021 Tour de France, powered by Super Sapiens. Energy management for committed athletes and coaches. Still guessing on fueling? Not sure what or when to eat and drink on rides that matter? Never again. Optimize your fueling strategy with real-time glucose data, actionable insight, and personalized analytics. We are here to help you achieve your performance goals. Go to supersapiens.com for more on how to track your energy levels and fuel for success.
Thank you very much indeed to our title sponsor, Super Sapiens. We're running a competition in conjunction with Super Sapiens to win 3 months' worth of Super Sapiens sensors. So you can track your blood glucose levels using the Super Sapiens app on your phone. Let's hear the latest entry in our competition tonight from a listener to the podcast, Rhea Fisher. Let's hear Rhea's pitch for Super Sapiens for 3 months.
My name's Rhea. And in October of this year, I'm attempting a 12-hour indoor bike ride for charity. I'm pretty new to endurance events. My longest ride time is about 7 hours, and I do have some food intolerances, which can make fueling quite challenging. I think that the Super Sapien system would be a great tool in helping me to learn how best to fuel the additional 5 hours, avoid any sugar crashes, and reach my time goal. I've started working on the longer endurance rides recently, and with the official training block due to begin soon, I'm hoping that with 3 months of Super Sapiens, I could really optimise my lead into October and do something really brilliant with my training.
Thank you very much for that, Rhea, and good luck. If you'd like to enter the competition, you still can. Go to thecyclingpodcast.com and you'll see how to submit your audio. Thanks once again, Super Sapiens, for sponsoring the Cycling Podcast. Before we go on to talk about today's stage, and we've got lots of interviews to hear tonight, including Chris Froome and others. Mitch, what's the beer that we're drinking here?
Yes, let's get to more important matters. And like I said, there is no local beer today, but luckily we've been stocking up along the way.
Certainly have.
And I'm going to go back a day, and this is the beer that I told you about yesterday that we bought on the side of the road before the bottom of Luz de Arden. Thank you. The climb. So we're drinking that beer, and this beer is called, it's from the brewery called Brassiere du Pays Toy. And I'm going to just read you a little bit about it. Situated breathtaking in the breathtaking Haute Pyrenees.
Haute Pyrenees.
Our family-run brewery produces a selection of fine English-style artisan ales using pure mountain spring water and the finest hops and malts a man can find. So they produce an amber beer, a porter brown, a blonde beer, and a white beer. Like we said, that's a pretty common theme with the Pyrenees craft beer. And I've pretty much know what we all drink now. So I'm drinking the IPA. Well, it didn't say they produce an IPA, but I'm drinking the IPA, which is the Luz de Arden. What are you drinking?
I'm on the Tourmalet, the Col de Tourmalet beer, the Ombre.
And Francois?
I'm drinking the white beer. It's called Pau, like the start town the other day. Well, one of the classic stage towns of Tour de France.
It's a beautiful beer. If we can just go a quick comparison to last night, we've all enjoyed it slightly more than last night.
Less sweet.
Less sweet, certainly. Last night's very sweet. I enjoyed last night's beers as well, but these are very nice. And our hotelier has done a very good job of making them cold very quickly.
Very quickly. They came out of a roasting hot car, and we chucked them in the freezer, and they're the great drinking temperature. So, not to go on about it too much tonight, a beautiful cleansing ale once again before we tuck into some dinner.
Great. Set us up nicely for dinner. And just before we go on, I mean, we stayed in Levi Scott's last night, podcast favourite. Mitch, your first experience of that. You said it was your first experience of sort of French fine dining. I think we would describe it as fine dining, wouldn't we?
Yeah.
And did it live up to the hype that I was guilty of ladling on it?
Very much so. The food, yes, but also the atmosphere. The chef came out, talked us through what he was going to prepare. We just let him take the reins, and I love that because these guys are out in the kitchen, and you want them to give you what they think is the best. And we just produced the food for us. But then the best part was, came out at the end, bottle of Armagnac, sat down, talked about the meal, and that was probably the best part of the whole evening was the food, the atmosphere, and just sitting down and feeling like part of the family there. It was a very special occasion.
And comparing actually his job as a chef to cycling, saying there were more and more young, very young chefs coming from nowhere and thinking
Slovenia?
Well, he didn't mention that, but he said, yeah, it's funny because he said the same thing as you hear from the peloton and the bunch, that these young chefs, they discover lots of things thanks to social media and on the internet and emerge as chefs at 22, 23. And he was thinking and saying, you know, they probably lacked the experience to last. And that's what we hear about riders as well, you know, becoming very pro in the junior ranks and kind of overlapping the under 23 category to become pros early on. And his impression as a chef was that, you know, maybe they were missing something, and we'll see. I mean, the future will say whether the same applies to cycling.
Well, listen, I enjoyed watching today's stage immensely. I think we were settling in for potentially a quite a boring sort of formulaic stage with a break and a bunch clawing them back and setting up a sprint. That wasn't what happened at all. And I really enjoyed watching it with you, Mitch, because you had a couple of teammates up there, Jonas and Michael Valgren as well. And it was fascinating to get your perspective on it as it was unfolding. As you said earlier, it looked a horrible group to be in. There were just too many of them, lots of strong riders as well, lots of attacks. And you're obviously watching it with a special eye on your teammates. And their tactics looked quite interesting. Jonas Rutsch was very aggressive, and it looked like Valgren was kind of holding back a little bit more. Was that what was happening there?
Well, I spoke to him at the end, Jonas, and I sort of suggested that they had a plan like that, but in the end I think it was just Jonas wanting to commit everything for the stage. And you know, sometimes in those breakaway moments, or even when you're trying to go for the break, it's sometimes that one extra attack that just breaks the cord. And I think he was trying to do that, even though it looked like he was setting Michael up. I think he actually didn't give Michael a chance to follow any attacks because he was just one after the other after the other. That was quite interesting. He's such a strong guy too that he's able to do that. That's what blew me away, that if you're watching the stage and you guys remember this, up that climb at the end, his face was just a picture of pain. And I thought he was going to be done. He was ending his race there. But he came back and attacked it again and again and again. So it was great to watch. It was great to see that. Laporte was very impressive for me, especially that sprint to the line. He just sat in the seat, just rode into second position. It was like no sprint or anything. It was quite a tough finish, but his strength was impressive.
And, you know, he'll look at that as a massive missed opportunity, won't he?
Yeah, I mean, you have to feel sorry for the Cofidis team and for the champagne bottle that's been sitting in their bus and it will probably be sitting in that bus for 14 years, because it's been 13 years since Cofidis haven't won a Tour de France stage, and they have this bottle of champagne in the bus ready for that day, and it'll be good aged champagne by the time because obviously they're not going to win the time trial tomorrow, unless something absolutely extraordinary happens. And, well, Christophe Laporte looked good today, but we don't really believe he'll win on the Champs-Élysées. So there's every chance that this bottle of champagne will stay one more year in the fridge in the bus.
Let's hear from the rider who finished third on the stage. Couldn't quite get round Laporte, Casper Pedersen of Team DSM, another team that was really out there today. Prepared for a sprint with Case Ball, but also aware that they had to try and seize an opportunity because they haven't won a stage at this year's Tour.
We were looking for you this morning to ask you how you were going to set up the sprint. Is that what you were expecting this morning as well?
Yeah, we were focused on a sprint, but we also knew that this was the last chance for many teams to get in a break. So all the teams without a favourite for the sprint would definitely try and go racing. So we were for sure ready for that scenario, and when it started being fireworks halfway through the stage, we were also there.
I mean, there were some crashes as well, but was it just those teams who are desperate for something from the race who forced that sort of racing that we saw today?
Yeah, I think there are still a lot of teams who maybe aren't super satisfied with the results they have so far, and this was the last chance for many teams, because a TT is pretty... Yeah, you know what you can do in a TT with your team, and Champs-Élysées is 99% chance of sprint. So that's, I think, why we saw this racing halfway. All the teams, they had nothing to lose, and they wanted to go racing.
And what did it feel like in that break? Was it, I mean, we saw Moritz get away with quite a long way out. What happened behind? I mean, was it just, it looked very stop-start, the guys were trying to jump, there was no real chase going on behind.
No, that's always the game in such a big group with such good riders. We all know how to race smart, and we everybody trying to be the smartest guy. So we look to each other, and the moment Mohoric, he has a small gap, then everybody's like saying, "I'm not gonna close it down." So that's also the game. You need to find that moment where everybody's looking to each other, and then you have to just go full gas in that moment, and that's what Mohoric did. And we also know that's what he's one of the best in the world at doing this, so he did it again.
So that was Casper Pedersen. When Moritz went away, you know, there were teams, Trek Segafredo in particular, a couple of strong riders in that group. Did those teams mess it up in the end?
I think so. It's very easy to say from watching the television, and you wonder whether there's individual sort of goals there opposed to a real committed team plan. Two guys that are very similar finishing attributes, you know, Edward Toons and Jasper Stuyven. You know, maybe they were just indecisive of who was really going to work for who there, you know, opposed to when you have two different style of riders, it's very clear who the guy's going to commit for the sprinter or vice versa. So that might have been a situation there. It's disappointing to see that, because I just feel like it's so obvious just to commit for one guy. But then again, if they'd shut it down to Mohoric, and, you know, just say Toons had committed to shut down Mohoric, his race was over, the next attack would have gone. There wasn't a guarantee it was going to stay together. That's also another thing too. Maybe they were playing the gamble card. We've just got to work together. We've got to get everyone rolling here, because if we commit, Mohoric is back, yes, but then next thing Valgren goes, next thing someone else goes.
But in the same time, Jasper Stuyven was in a breakaway with Moric in the longest stage of the tour to Le Creusot, and if I remember well, he came second. So I mean, you know, when he saw Moric go, he felt that the scenario was playing again. I don't know, maybe that led to the an decision. And if you look at the results, I mean, the Toons finished ahead of him. So was there a kind of disagreement there?
You'd think that'd almost be more motivation for Stuyven to go, you know what? I'm not letting you get away. You beat me last time. I'm just going to commit. I'm going to chase you back. It's so surprising for me that they let. That's probably not the right word, but they saw Mohoric go, and even 10 seconds, you just can't give that guy 10 seconds. You can't give him 10 meters.
No, I mean, he's obviously super strong. I mean, we remember his terrible crash at the Giro that saw him out of that race. He's always been a brilliant rider who perhaps hasn't achieved as much as a senior as his pedigree as a junior and under 23 rider suggested he would, but he shows in flashes this incredible ability that he has. But he has been and his team have been at the center of this story that's bubbling away after the police raid a couple of nights ago. He's been pretty angry by that. And I thought him winning is just going to breathe new life into this story. I'm sure that ASO and the Tour de France would have rather somebody from another team won. But then he exacerbated that with this gesture at the end. I mean, I don't know what you made of it, Francois, the kind of be quiet gesture.
Yeah, I was wondering. Yeah, I was wondering what he meant by that. Probably, a lot was said, after yesterday about the fact that he was very outspoken about complaining about the police raid. So maybe it was kind of a way to say, well, so you want me to shut up? This is my answer. That's the way I saw it. Because we know he's a clever guy. We know he's a literate guy. He's not like a bully
cerebral.
He's kind of cerebral, right? He's kind of an intellectual. He's a guy who brings books and reads books on the Tour de France. I mean, like Bauke Mollema. Obviously did that gesture on purpose, and he knew what he was doing.
Well, I asked him about it at the end because we waited for a long time to speak to him after he'd won the stage and managed to grab a quick word with him.
I guess not the day you expected today. We most of us expected a bunch sprint, but I heard you say you lined up near the front to be ready for anything today.
Yeah, I said, we said at the bus this morning it's probably going to be a sprint if they control, but we all know it's third week. Teams have weekend rosters, some riders are tired, some riders are injured, some riders are sick. So you never know, it's just two teams that have really won sprint stages, so nobody's really gonna try and give them a helping hand. So it's always gonna be possibility to have chaos at the start, especially then when I said better safe than sorry start in the front. And then I saw kilometer zero was on a very hilly road, narrow, a lot of road furniture. I said, oh, this has potential to be a big chaos, no? And then when I saw the first breakaway going, I said to myself, yeah, now you have to try to bridge across and maybe see how it plays out if some other group comes from the back or something. And then they didn't. Peloton settled down. But I still tried to, because I invested a lot of energy into that breakaway. I said, yeah, guys, we are here. Now we should maybe try and do our best. We should ride hard as we can for first 2 hours and see if maybe Peloton gives up the chase. Maybe we have an option to fight for the stage win. And this is great for everyone involved, no? And they agreed, and we did that. But then, unfortunately for us, there was another big group of breakaway riders bridging across to us, and then that make it a lot more complicated. But I never stopped believing in myself. I tried to focus on my own race, doing my best possible performance. And when Niels Pollitt made that decisive move, I said to myself, yeah, Matej, now go as hard as you can, do one more sprint, one more effort, and then if you're finished, you're finished. You have a successful tour. I didn't really, I just went for it and I didn't never look back.
And you've been asked a lot about the victory gesture. I mean, was that something you thought about before the finish? Was that a gesture that you wanted to make?
No, I just wanted to make sure that people know that we are, all of us, all the riders in the Tour de France, we're all working hard, putting a lot of effort into being the best version of ourselves, to be ready for this race, to be prepared, and that all the people that comment on this from their couches and from the comfort of their own homes should maybe sometimes think twice about what they say. And yes,
justice.
Have you been aware of a lot of that on social media and stuff? There's been a lot of comment the last day or so.
No, I try to stay away from them.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, to remind us to tell you that this episode is sponsored by MAP, the Melbourne-based cycling clothing company who are doing some really interesting stuff when it comes to the design and also the technical aspects of cycling kit. Their materials are sourced, selected and rigorously tested, always with the rider at the forefront of their thinking. And we've been sent some MAP kit, or more specifically Richard has. He's keeping my jersey and bib shorts safe, I trust, and will get them over to me in the UK. But Richard's been riding in the Evade jersey, which is made with ultra soft Italian fabrics, and also the Emblem Pro Hex jersey, which has the four-way stretch woven Hextech sleeve fabric, which is not only super light, but it means the jersey fits really well both on and off the bike. And he's also got the Team Bib Evo, which is the seventh generation of MAP's bib shorts with 3D thermo molded chamois technology, manufactured by Elastic Interface in Italy. Now that's the theory, but what about the practice? Richard, you've been riding in the mountains in the Pyrenees there for a couple of days. Now when you're riding in the mountains, of course, it's warm going up and cool going down, so that seems like the perfect place to put the kit through its paces. It looks good, but how did it shape up on the bike?
Well, Lionel, it shaped up incredibly well. And as you say, I am keeping your jersey and shorts safe out here in France. And we're safer than on my actual person. I've managed to wear both sets of the MAP kit and thoroughly enjoyed wearing them both. A word for the Evade jersey, which I wore on my big long ride in Andorra. It wasn't very warm there at all. In fact, it was pretty cold. And I climbed up to 2,100 meters and got pretty hot on the way up, was gushing sweat, and began to realize I didn't have any extra clothing. And I could see riders coming down the hill, kind of dressed up, and I started to worry that I'd underestimated the conditions. But I stopped at the top, turned around, and my kit was within seconds absolutely bone dry. The shirt and the base layer shirt and shorts, and I was absolutely fine coming back down the descent. So it was a phenomenal experience, actually, and I thoroughly have enjoyed wearing the kit. I wore it yesterday on my ride with Mitch as well, and I'll be wearing it tomorrow when we go and recce the time trial route. But I've been very impressed. The fit is excellent. As I said a couple of nights ago, it feels really fast, and no excuses for me, basically. To get your hands on some MAP kit with 15% off the full price items, go to map.cc/cycling. That's map.cc/cycling. Then enter the offer code cycling15, cycling and the numbers 1 and 5, before the end of July to get your hands on some of this fabulous cycling kit. Well, fellas, Stacey Snyder's cups, mugs and gelato bowls went back on sale, second batch today, and sold out within minutes once again. I don't want to make any inaccurate claims for how quickly they sold out, but they sold out very, very quickly, raising lots of money for brain tumour research, a cause inspired by our listener and friend of the podcast, Liam Bergen, who did a ride recently to raise funds for brain tumour research and has a brain tumour himself, and we've been following his story and are delighted to contribute to that very good cause. So thanks once again to everybody who bought one of these items, and sorry if you tried to get one and couldn't, but they will be going on sale, I guess, for the Vuelta again, and we'll just carry on as long as they sell, and they're selling very quickly. We've also been running, or we've been asking for nominations for Pedaleur de Charme. We've had lots and lots of nominations, and lots of really great nominations. A few of you have nominated Tim de Klerk, the De Koninck Quickstep rider, El Tractor. He will actually get a cup anyway, as one of our audio diarists. Stacey has made him, I think she might have even made him a special cup with a tractor on it. So that's nice. So he'll get one. We've actually made a decision about who should be the Pedaleur de Charme of this year's Tour de France. And it's Chris Juul Jensen, the Danish rider, Danish-Irish rider on Team Bike Exchange. I mentioned this last night, but a couple of days ago after the Col du Porte, as they descended the climb to go back to their buses, which not a lot of people will know, but the riders often in the mountains have to then ride maybe up to 15 kilometers back to their bus. This was the case a couple of days ago, and Yul Jensen, Philip Gilbert and Chris Froome came upon a rider who was out watching the tour who fell quite some distance off the road. And it transpired, or I learned this morning, that it was Yul Jensen who actually went to his assistance. Now, Yul Jensen is always a great guy for us to speak to. He's a sort of favourite of the podcast. And I think for this gesture, for what he did to help somebody, he would be he is a thoroughly deserving Pedlar de Charme. I spoke to him this morning. I also spoke to Chris Froome, who was on the scene as well. Let's hear from both of them now. Initially Chris Froome, and then Chris Yul Jensen.
First of all, can I ask you about this incident the other day with you, Philip Gilbert, and Chris Yul Jensen came to the rescue of somebody?
Unfortunately, it was coming down from Col de Porte. There was a guy just in front of me who hit some gravel on a corner, managed to hold it up, but in the process went through basically the apex of the bend and straight over the edge just in front of me. So naturally I stopped to try and see if he was all right and try and call an ambulance to help him, because he definitely seemed quite out of it and quite, to me it looked as if he had a concussion. But yeah, he definitely needed to be checked out medically. But that's an unfortunate side of bike racing that we all know too well.
How are you feeling, Chris? I mean, now close to the end of the tour, what's this tour felt like for you?
It's been pretty brutal. Obviously, day one, that crash set me back a bit, and it feels as if I've been sort of playing catch up ever since then. I'm still having to put dressings on an open wound that's still 3 weeks later, still causing me issues, still sleeping on the left side, ribs are still painful. The body's been through it these last few weeks, but I'm really glad to have been here all the same, to be absorbing this racing. One side I do feel has really come along a lot is the accelerations within the peloton. I feel as if I'm handling that a lot better now than when I came into this race. I've obviously got a lot of work to do going forward, but this tour has given me a lot of motivation. It's been fascinating to see the younger generation of guys who have come up, and I certainly hope to come back to future editions to be able to be up there fighting it out with them.
Would Chris Froome at his best beat Tadej Pogacar at his best?
I mean, that's something I'd love to find out. I'm going to have to work harder than I've ever worked before to get there. But this was, I think, a really important step for me to be here and to go through this.
And the Vuelta, Chris, is the Vuelta on your program this year as well?
It's on the cards at the moment. Still haven't made a decision one way or another yet on that, but it's definitely on the cards.
We asked Chris about it as well, Chris Froome. You went down to help the guy, I believe. What happened?
Well, I don't know. Maybe there's a bit more of a spring in my step compared to Philip Gilbert and Chris Froome, but no, they're the two who saw the accident. I actually didn't see the crash, and they seemed pretty concerned and pointed to a guy who was sort of sitting, not in the ditch, but like, you know, on the bank of the mountain, rather dazed and confused. And they took the initiative to call the ambulance, and then I hopped off my bike and went down to see if the guy was all right. And he seemed okay. He was certainly very, very confused and dazed. Bit of a launch he'd taken off the road. But actually, when he realized what had happened and that his bike was maybe 10 meters away from him, then he became more concerned about his bike, and was in a lot of distress over whether his bike was damaged or not. But I grabbed his bike and we straightened out the handlebars, and I think both him and the bike were okay.
He was okay. So as far as you were concerned, when you left him, he seemed to be okay.
Yeah, that was my impression. I mean, I think he was from the Basque Country, and because he lost his phone during the crash, and then someone asked if they could call it, and he started telling them his phone number, and then he started telling them his phone number in English, where I think I came to the conclusion, not that I have any experience with sort of telling whether or not the guy had a concussion, but you know, he seemed pretty bright enough to remember his telephone number even in English. So I felt sorry for the guy. I mean, I think you see often is the case when we descend down from the finish, it is a bit sketchy, especially with the touring riders. Usually they're mostly just in awe of the fact that they get a chance, a rare opportunity to ride down the mountain with us. And I think I spoke to Froome about it, and he said he felt a bit guilty because it seemed like the guy was glancing over his shoulder just to get a glance at the great Chris Froome. And then, you know, he overcooked the corner and went flying, but luckily nothing happened. And I felt sorry for him because it sort of puts things into perspective. We don't really think about how much a bike is worth, and you know, if we break a bike, we get a new one. It doesn't really matter. But to him, you know, I think even had he had two broken legs, he would have still been more in tears over the prospect of losing his bike. But I think both bike and rider were okay.
It's something that people who've not been at the tour probably don't realize, but the last 2 days at the end of the stage, you know, you finish the stage and then you got to ride quite a long way off, and last night was quite a long way back down to the buses.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of, in the beginning, it's just the sense of relief that the stage is over. It's a mountain stage. You typically end, you know, finish up high, and then you have the freedom to dawdle down a descent, you know, by yourself, sort of digest and reflect upon the stage you've just done. But then gradually, as it seems like the bus is further away, you start to think, geez, this is a bit of a ball ache. Especially if you haven't got enough clothes on. But no, I mean, you can't really complain about it when, as soon as the race ends, everything seems pretty blissful. But it is something you need to take into account. But, you know, here and many other races, they've started to become quite good at restricting the amount of fans who descend along with the riders, but you can't avoid it completely. And you do see pretty bad and unfortunate accidents, but I mean, yeah.
All in the day's work for you at the Tour de France, I guess.
Yeah. I was surprised actually it made the headlines. I just told a few guys on the team, but I can understand that Froome and Gilbert have also told the journalists. But I hope that my attributes on the bike in the race are more known than or out of the race. But I'm glad I didn't just ride by and not really care. I think it's like human nature that you'd want to hop down and see if he's all right. So from hopping down the ditch to see if Lewis Hamilton was okay a couple of days ago to hopping down the ditch to see if a fan was all right. It's a person at the end of the day. They've got to make sure they're okay.
Science in Sport is supporting the cycling podcast at the 2021 Tour de France. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much indeed to Science and Sport for their support of the cycling podcast. If you want 25% off all your Science and Sport products, go to scienceandsport.com and enter the code SISCP25 at the checkout. If you'd like to enter the competition that we're running with Science and Sport to predict the winner of Sunday's stage into Paris, go to thecyclingpodcast.com. You can still enter and be in with a chance of winning £80 worth of Science and Sport sports nutrition products. So tomorrow, the time trial, chaps, what do we... It's not the denouement that Prudhomme and ASO would have wanted, because in terms of the overall, there's really not a lot to be decided. You could say the podium's pretty settled. And that's not ideal. You know, a time trial like this right at the end of the race is much more interesting if there's something at stake. As we saw last year at La Planche des Belles Filles, there turned out to be a lot more at stake there than we imagined beforehand. But what is there tomorrow to look forward to, Francois, apart from wine?
Well, there'll be lots of wine and good wines, you know, along the way, but we'll get back to it tomorrow. But yeah, obviously the way, you know, Tadej Pogacar was talking about tomorrow's race, you know, in interviews, I mean, is you know, it looks even better. I mean, of course, he won three stages already and won the Tour. So, I mean, he'll have no pressure, totally relaxed, the best man on the bike, the best man on the course. I really can't see how he can be beaten. I mean, sometimes we hesitate. We say, oh, yeah, but a specialist like Stephen Kung came close in Laval and, you know, was beaten by Pogacar. You know, obviously all these guys are real TT specialists. Will go for it. Will do their best. But as happens most of the time in the last time trial of the Tour, you know, the top guys in the GC usually are, you know, even more motivated. And I wouldn't be surprised to see Jonas Vingegaard finishing second. We don't know about Carapaz. That's maybe the little question mark in terms of the GC. But I mean, his lead over Ben O'Connor and the fact that Ben O'Connor is not a TT specialist either, you know, he should stay in place.
It would need a spectacular collapse.
Yeah, absolutely. So I don't think really we should expect any surprise. So yeah, enjoy the scenery, enjoy the view, enjoy the names of the wines we'll be seeing. And it's always spectacular, especially if the weather is nice, to see. I actually like time trials. I mean, it's a pure effort. The fine art of pedaling, and sometimes can be really beautiful. And with the scenery we'll have tomorrow, I think just enjoy the beauty of the sport. I mean, that's what we. I mean, it's going to be more an aesthetic kind of pleasure tomorrow than the suspense of what's at stake.
Mitch, do you like time trials? Doing them or watching them?
I was lucky enough to do a time trial through the Barolo region, another beautiful region, wine region, and I didn't have to do much that day apart from get in, which is mostly the case for me with time trials, and I really got to absorb the region, which can be a lucky thing if a guy just has to ride in. And when I say ride in, for anyone out there thinking it's just sort of, sit up and cruising coffee ride, you still have to put a fair bit of pressure on the pedals, but the pressure is off. The psychological pressure, so you can actually look around sometimes and enjoy it. What I wanted to say also, which will be the case for quite a lot of guys tomorrow, what I wanted to say also about what you were saying about the GC men having more motivation than, say, the individual time trialists, I think another thing that comes into play is that at this point in the race, they have also got through the race at a different way than, say, a guy like Stefan Kung. And maybe Luke Durbridge or these guys who are pure time trialists, they lose that edge. As they get more tired, they're fresh one-day time trialists, and they're able to produce that one effort at the start of tours or on a one-day time trial very good. And these Grand Tour riders, these GC men, they're getting to the end of this race, I wouldn't say fresh, but fresher than a guy like Stefan Kung. And that's what I find amazing is these end time trial results, they sometimes throw a real spanner in the works.
Like last year, yeah. And but Kung, I mean, a huge opportunity for him to rescue his team's tour, because they've had a disappointing tour, and a stage win right at the death would probably be very welcome for Groupama FDJ, I would suspect. Francois, have you got some French culture for us? Any culture around here? Anything? Anything at all?
Breweries or anything?
Any breweries? Any craft beer?
Well, they actually make they're making a beverage that's funny, because we started in Brittany and we're finishing in the south of France, and then of course in Paris to wrap it up. But one thing you if you don't know it, but I'll tell it, there's a real divide in France between the beer the beer France, that's the north of France, and the wine France, that's the south of France, and also a big divide between the butter France, that's the north of France, and the olive oil France, that's the south of France. So that might be why the guy here, Wes Vines himself, was kind of not insulted, but you're
furious. He was absolutely furious.
You're either in wine country or in beer country, and you're either in butter country or in olive oil country, and that divide, which is the Loire River, actually is very important for people. And there you are. So I was talking about the Loire, which is the biggest river in France, with the Rhône. But we have here, and we're in Libourne. We're not far from Libourne, where we arrived today. And there's a big river, and you probably saw it in the images of the statue at the finish, called La Garonne. And La Garonne, when it comes to Bordeaux, it becomes the mouth of the Garonne goes into the ocean. And it's called La Gironde, and that's the name of the department, La Gironde. And every year, when you have the high tide in the area, you have and that's the word of the day, it's mascaré. Mascaré, if you ask about mascaré in the area, everybody knows what it is. And it's that day. I mean, you have the same thing in Wales and in lots of countries in the world. But it's the day when there's a big wave coming back from the ocean because of the tide, and it goes back in the river, and you've got this wave coming inland for miles, and every year there's a big mascaré going up to Libourne, and all the surfers in the area, there's lots of surfers in the area because you've got great beaches in the area, Arcachon, Lacano, where they've got a work up leg, surfing leg in Lacano, and so I mean the Mascarille is a very important moment for Libourne. Everybody comes there to see the guys coming, you know, on that wave in the on the river. You got stars, you know, going on a woody, you know, and on a board and trying to stay as long as they can on that wave. And so that's an important moment in the life of Libourne. So in case you know, you're in the area, you know, so obviously it's not the same day every year. It depends on tides. You have to watch out for it. But it's an important moment in the life of Libourne, the tidal wave of Libourne. Cheese, you know, we have beer of the day, cheese. So we started in Brittany with very few cheeses because it's not a cheese-making country. Gironde, which is the area here, doesn't have many cheese either because it's not a grazing country you see well because it's, once again, it's a river mouth. And so you have a little bit of land, like in Pauillac, but it's not, usually, you know, it's not made for cheese. But there is one called Tom de Bazas, and it's actually the only cheese produced in the Gironde department. And it's like, it's back to the time when sheep were taken from the mountains of the Basque country, where we were, in the Pyrenees, and down to the plain marshes of Gironde to graze. And so, you know, from this time, they would have been doing Tom de Bazas, and you couldn't find it in the shops around here. And that's unfortunately the only cheese they have in the area. So I don't know what cheese I'm going to talk about tomorrow. Well, hopefully we'll find a beer as well. I mean, we'll be short of cheese and short of beer at the time trial anyway. There's a few sides, but I come back to it tomorrow. On the course tomorrow, we'll be going close to Château Pétrus, which is, and I'll come back to it tomorrow, which is the most expensive wine in the world. We'll be also, today, actually, we went almost past Château d'Yquem. It's home to the most famous white wine in the world. It was actually appreciated by George Washington, the first president of the United States. But the wine of Yquem already had a long history, unlike Petrus, which started in the 20th century. Actually, the story of Château d'Yquem, the peloton went past it very quickly. There were lots of breakaways, so you didn't have lots of time to watch it. But it actually began in 1453 when Aquitaine, then English, was attached to the Kingdom of France. A century later, a local notable, Jacques Sauvage, was granted the rights of simple tenure of Yquem and thus became the first in a long line of passionate wine growers. And so it's a privileged Sauternes terroir. We are in the region of Sauternes with exceptional climatic and geological properties. Château d'Yquem obtained its letters of nobility in 1855 with the title of Premier Cru Supérieur. Since then, that distinction has guided the genius of this sweet wine. The 200 families, so you have two families owned in the area, the Sauvage and L'Ursalus, they have been protected for over 400 years. But in 1999, that the Château d'Yquem, because you know it's so prestigious, became property of the LVMH luxury group, and the château itself, if you go on a visit there, is listed as an historical monument. So you know Château d'Yquem, one of the probably the most famous white wine in the world, if we exclude champagne out of it. Today we started from Mourenx, and the funny thing about Mourenx is it was actually a nothing town before 1958. It didn't exist. It's like a kind of a mushroom town, and it was actually before 1958. It was a village of 200 souls, but it was built at an extremely fast pace after 1958, and a few years later had almost 12,000 inhabitants because they actually found the deposit of gas there, you know, and so it was like, you know, a mushroom town. Everybody flocked to try and exploit the gas.
And they've got a velodrome now.
It's got a velodrome, yeah, and the velodrome is named after Eddie Merckx. And the reason why it's named after Eddie Merckx, and Eddie Merckx were there at the start, is that in his 1969 Tour de France, when he won everything, almost like Tadej Pogacar, all the jerseys on offer, won stages, and this may be one of his most unbelievable feats in the 1969 Tour de France, was he attacked on the stage going to Mourenx. It was a 240k stage, which was quite common at the time. And he remained on his own for 140Ks and won the stage with an 8-minute lead over the second guy. You know, so that was Merckx in the day.
It was that performance that gave rise to the term Merckxissimo, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
I think Jacques Gaudet coined that the next day.
Absolutely. But it's still seen as probably is the one of the most exciting feats in his career that has well, as we know, lots of them. And they build that this town, and the funny thing is, when it was inaugurated, the General de Gaulle was there, and Nikita Khrushchev, the Soviet leader at the time, came to see the development of the of this project, and so the first inhabitants of the who came there in the late 1950s that are still, you know, seen as pioneers, and they call themselves the pioneers, you know, like maybe Merckx was kind of a pioneer of the cycling we know today. So that was to Merckx. So we mentioned Merckx. We also went past at kilometer 71. We went through Mont-de-Marsan, and Mont-de-Marsan is also known for a famous rider who was probably the leading rival of Eddy Merckx, Luis Ocaña, the Spaniard of Mont-de-Marsan, who lived there for most of his life and short life, and made his career in Mont-de-Marsan. So yeah, full of cycling history in today's stage.
Yeah. Now you're being given a night off singing tonight, Francois, because we have got a guest submission.
Keep them coming.
Just before we go, a few people have been asking Mitch how or if you're training while you're here with us, because you're running the Tour of Poland soon and the Eneco Tour, and then Paris-Roubaix will be your final race as a professional. But you are training, you're getting on the bike, but you run as well, which is quite unusual for a professional rider. You've been a couple of runs.
I do, yeah. I sort of started running, I don't know, 5-6 years ago now, as a thing in the off season, because I enjoy it. And anyone out there who runs knows it's just a different sort of high to cycling. You can achieve something so quick in a run that you can't achieve riding, and they're two different things. But just if you like exercising and you like getting that sort of runner's high or exercise high, it's really great. It's also really good for the bone density. And as cyclists, as we get older, we don't do much apart from ride. We don't really walk around much. We don't play games. So it's also another good thing to make you feel a little bit more like a normal human being. And it's also really great. Like, we get back from these long days at, you know, 7 o'clock, and 20, 30 minutes, get out in the shoes, run around Saint Emilion today. I already know the area better than you do.
You do, you do. We're going to go for a ride tomorrow. I'm probably going to rip your legs off again like I did yesterday, as we recce the time.
Oh, it's on.
Yeah, oh, no,
I'll go out and do 100K before we start. Let's do it.
Just to get the engine revving. But we'll do that. And like I say, we've got a guest song tonight. Benjamin Joseph, a Dorset musician, window cleaner, and enthusiastic part-time cyclist is how he describes himself. Thanks for your email, Benjamin. Lovely sentiments. But he says that hearing Francois invite musical submissions, oh, how you might regret this, he says in brackets, I'm sending you a recording of a song I put together for a bit of fun, inspired by the Tour, the Giro, and most importantly, Lionel's 1101 Cappuccino. Thank you, Francois.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mitch.
Big meal tonight, mate. Huge ride tomorrow.
Let's hear Benjamin Joseph to play out.
I'll ever know one cappuccino sends me away 2 kilometers zero to the mud pretend or the cold Columbia to the winds I vomit. I could be finger God, quietly chasing, could be Pogachar, so unrelenting, maybe Carapaz, who won't give up fighting, or the king of the mountain, the king of the Peter's again, a point solid plan.